You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Hello, welcome into the 8th episode of the Last Word in Sports College Football Podcast. My name is Austin Craycraft, and I'm joined today by Yesh Ginsberg. How are we doing, Yesh?
I'm good today. Glad to be on for a second straight week.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Today we'll be reviewing week 3 of the college football season. It was a pretty exciting one, plenty of notable games, and it was the weekend of the dropped before they enter the end zone fumble. Happened twice, both very controversially, and one more. They've kind of in the talk of the weekend in some circles. And, what were your just overall takeaways from week 3, Yesh?
I think we'll get to the dropping the ball before they cross the goal line later. General takeaway from week 3, it's all about the Big Ten and the Big 12. Right, the Big Ten had, by their standards, not by any standards, an amazing week. 5-0 against Power 5 competition, wins over Duke, Notre Dame, Nebraska beat Oregon, Oklahoma, and I'm missing one in Colorado. That's not worth so much. We'll get to that. Colorado played very well this week. It was surprising. Big wins. Nebraska's looking like a contender. Tommy Armstrong, we'll get to them later also. Tommy Armstrong playing very well. That really makes Nebraska function well. His mistakes, for all his talent, he's made mistakes over the years that have cost the team a lot. Ohio State looked dominant, and the Big Ten just looks in great position. And the Big 12, conversely, right, it's very hard to look at someone out of that conference who has a good chance to make the playoff right now. Baylor's still undefeated, but no one knows how they're doing with the whole losing coach and the whole scandal there, so no one's really quite sure of them. Right, Texas got, we realized that maybe we jumped a little too much on the bandwagon after the Notre Dame victory. Oklahoma was not quite embarrassed, but thoroughly beaten. Oklahoma State survived against Pitt. Oklahoma State was the high point for the conference this week. And, of course, after last week's, we'll say controversial loss to Central Michigan, they responded well. But, yeah, Big 12 doesn't look in such a good position, and the Big 10 looks strong.
Yeah, I firmly agree with both those. Well, let's get right into it. Let's jump to the SEC, where one of the best games of the weekend happened. We had Ole Miss going for a third straight victory over Alabama, but they came up just short as the Crimson Tide win 48-43. Alabama, they went on a 45-6 run behind a dominant running game who was getting 7 yards per carry. And for Ole Miss, they just need to stop in all phases of the game. They gave up multiple just touchdowns in all three phases that were ultimately very costly. Chad Kelly had his normal interception like every week, But one positive for the Rebels, I was impressed by their pass defense. They were able to limit Jalen Hurts a little bit through the air, not let him get out to the playmakers, but it ultimately was not enough. What did you take away from this one?
Well, I was also impressed with Ole Miss's with passing offense. Kelly had the bad interception, but right, there's no more Laquon Treadwell here, but Ole Miss got some serious yards through the air against Alabama, which until tonight, people thought it was only possible if your name was Johnny Manziel. They found real holes in the Alabama secondary. They found lots of underneath throws that got good yardage. I was impressed with how Ole Miss managed to move the ball via the passing game. Ole Miss just needs to work on, a lot of things, but some sort of loss of intensity. I don't know how to quantify it, but right, the second straight game where, you know, in the second quarter, they built a huge lead, and all of a sudden it collapsed. Second straight game, sorry, they won in between. Second game of the season, right, this and the Florida State game to open the year. Right, some sort of collapse after opening up a huge lead early. the fact that they can open up a 21-point lead on Alabama should certainly be, you know, just something that the team should really point to. And no one's done it since 2008 or 2009, since Saban really got the team back in the right direction. So, no, that should be something that they should be able to be proud of. But just not finishing the game is something that should be very concerning. Also, Alabama, Ole Miss, I don't think there's another team on Alabama's schedule that can really exploit the secondary like Ole Miss did. I don't think there's any other team Alabama will face with a quarterback who's as good a passer and with as good a wide receiver core as Ole Miss has. But that's something they've got time to fix it. But if they meet a team like Ohio State in the playoffs, right, that's something that Alabama should be very nervous about, because Ohio State has a better all-around game than Ole Miss, but a better running game, a better passing, and better offensive line. And if Ole Miss can move the ball through the air like that against Alabama, then if they ever meet Ohio State, unless they can make some changes to adjust for that, that's not looking like a good matchup for the Alabama defense.
Yeah, that's really been the only way to beat the Crimson Tide lately. Ole Miss has that formula down, and as you said, if Ohio State meets them again in the playoff, they could certainly cause some problems. But, yeah, I don't think any of the Crimson Tide opponents present the same problems that the Rebels do. If they can shut down the running games of many of these teams coming up on their schedule, they shouldn't have too many problems. That game at LSU will obviously still be tough, but they are looking extremely strong and just like your normal Alabama team. Anything more to say on that one, Yesh?
No, not particularly. Alabama does look good. The slight problems with passing defense, notwithstanding, the offensive line looks dominant. Right, the running game, Scarborough looks like another just strong, fast Alabama running back that we've seen so much in recent years. You know, with Trent Richardson, Derrick Henry, Mark Ingram, another in that mold. Yeah, Alabama looks strong.
Yeah, now let's move up to the Big Ten, where Michigan State came away. They're probably among the most impressive teams this weekend. I didn't really see this coming. I thought Notre Dame was going to take this one, but Michigan State just looked like your typical old Michigan State team, controlling the pace on the ground. And by the end, it gave itself plenty of room for error, which it needed every bit of it as they made it closer than it probably should have been. But I came away impressed by the Spartans' run defense. They really eliminated that aspect of the game and just made it so that Kaiser had to beat them, which might actually have been a good thing for Notre Dame, because that's the way that they can beat you, because Kaiser's so good. But I ultimately thought the play calling for Notre Dame was a little suspect, because I think they called some run plays and some iffy situations when Kaiser had kind of been moving the ball very well throughout the game. What did you see out of the Spartans that you liked?
Well, I'll tell you what I saw that I didn't like. Michigan State, they started a little slow. That's fine. They got into the game. They let off the gas way too early. This game was 36-7 or 35-7. This should have been a blowout. Michigan State was just had all the momentum, had everything, and then the defense stopped sending pressure as much. Right, they let Kaiser get into a rhythm. The defense just didn't. Right, there were a few sequences in a row in the second and third quarter where the Michigan State defense was just taking it to Notre Dame, and they backed off of that. The offense got a little bland also after that. After they stopped also late in the third quarter, and they really had Notre Dame back to this game. If Michigan State had played the whole game the way they played their best six sequences, this is a 50-point win. So Michigan State clearly talented, clearly motivated, clearly is going to be very dangerous in the Big Ten, going to be very dangerous against anyone they play, really. But they, again, like Ole Miss, like I said about Ole Miss, they let Notre Dame back in the game. They lost intensity, or they backed off a little because they thought the game was in hand. But whatever the reason was, Michigan State did not finish this game as strongly as they played for the middle of it, which almost came back to bite them.
And you saw the two-headed monster for the Spartans really come through in L.J. Scott and Gerald Holmes. And that's kind of what we're used to from the Spartans is just they typically only have one bell cow running back, but this year they might have two. So that is certainly a advantage for the Spartans. And Tyler O'Connor, he looked solid throughout the game. What do you see from – do you see anything from Notre Dame that could inspire Fighting Irish fans after a 1-2 start?
I mean, the team is talented. The team is young. The schedule gets a lot easier from here. There are a few more tough games, but this should be an easy 8-win season just because of the way the schedule lines up. I don't know, easy. At least just 7 is the absolute minimum. This is a rebuilding year, right? They returned very little from last year. Last year, a lot of talent graduated and left the NFL. So the team, this is right. Even if this is a year to step backwards, it shouldn't be something that Notre Dame fans are dismayed over because the team's clearly got talent, clearly heading in the right direction overall. Even if this year is a little bit of a step backwards, Kaiser's fun to watch. And Notre Dame fans should never be disappointed about having Deshaun Kaiser quarterback. Got some good wide receivers to throw to make plays down the field. It should be it might not be a great year in South Bend. It might not be right, they're hoping to be in the playoff, which looks like it won't happen this year. But it's definitely better than we've seen under the previous few coaches. And Notre Dame's definitely heading still in the right direction towards being, you know, relevant to the playoff conversation year in and year out.
Yeah, I think it's certainly an unfortunate start for the Irish, but as you said, the schedule does lighten up a bit and well, 8-4 is probably a disappointment for some Irish fans. I think the future is bright, and we'll see how they progress as the season goes on and going into that Stanford game October 15th. Let's move on to a game that you were watching very closely, the Ohio State-Oklahoma game. Ohio State beats the Sooners 45-24 in Norman. And it was really the Noah Brown coming out party. Five catches for four of them coming from a touchdown, one of the best touchdown grabs you'll ever see. If you haven't seen it, you should go check it out. He pins it on the guy's back, and it's quite impressive. The other big storyline is how really everyone in the entire stadium and the broadcasting crew and the refs all missed Joe Mixon dropping the touchdown on his 97-yard kick return touchdown.
Well, if you follow me on Twitter, I didn't miss it. I saw the play. The TV, if you watch it live, really didn't give you such a good angle on it. So, like, because they zoomed out of him on the field to just show his face and zoomed in on just to show his, you know, his torso and upper body as he crossed the goal line. So you had to kind of, like, project it as to see when he dropped the ball. But if you follow me on Twitter, you see I pointed out immediately. So I'm linking to someone else I follow also. I think Randy Gerko saw it immediately. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I apologize. Saw it immediately. And then they found replays that clearly showed it. But that shouldn't be the main story of the game again, right? Well, I'll get to this later. But, right, what would happen? The ball didn't go out of bounds. So the ball just laid dead in the end zone. Would have been an Oklahoma's ball on the one-yard line anyway, first and goal. So I don't know why that's such a big story, other than the fact that it's just crazy that people can't just run all the way into the end zone and give the ball to the referee. Or even rugby style, just run in and put it down in the end zone. Right, do something, make sure you score. I don't know why this happens. So it's just a story because of how ridiculous it really is. But right, that shouldn't be the biggest takeaway from this game. The biggest thing with this game is JT Barrett, the quarterback, Noah Brown at receiver, catching some good, not quite jump balls, but some of those were not, you know, passes. They were not perfect passes that are meant to be, were only the receiver catching. Some of them were tough catches. Ohio State just looked dominant throughout, looked dominant on the lines. The game could have been a little closer at a few plays on Oklahoma's game. It could have gone Oklahoma's way. It could have been just easily been a much bigger blowout. But I think the main takeaway from this game is that Ohio State looks very good, and I don't know who on their schedule can be. The Michigan State will be tough like always, but Ohio State just looks in another league right now.
Yeah, I admittedly hadn't watched too much Buckeye football. I'd I've watched bits and pieces of their first two games, but I just really noticed all the speed that they have. It's like they didn't even lose all those draft picks from a year ago. Mike Weber is very talented at running back, and Curtis Samuel, you just kind of want to get the ball in his hands any way possible, and obviously JT Barrett looked very solid.
I just want to say Curtis Samuel, I don't know what he did over the offseason. He looks faster this year than he ever has before. Maybe it's just because he was buried behind Ezekiel Elliott, but I don't think so. He looks much faster here than I've ever seen from him before, and that's definitely a good thing.
Yeah, he's one of the more exciting players to watch in the country. And as we transition over to the Oklahoma side of the ball, Baker Mayfield, he didn't impress too much in this game. He made plenty of costly mistakes that really did the Sooners in and put them in a hole that they really just couldn't come back from. He had those two interceptions. He didn't make timely plays. And the Ohio State running game was able to shut down Samaje Perine inside, only allowing 3.5 yards per carry. But as we look forward to this Oklahoma team, they have a very, very real chance of starting 1-4. Because their schedule coming up, they have a bye this weekend, and then they go to TCU, and then they have the Red River Shootout against Texas. So it's completely possible they do it. So it might be time to worry down in Norman.
Well, I'm going to be a little more enthusiastic about Oklahoma than you are, because I think this is a very talented team. I think there's a little bit of concern, not on Baker Mayfield's end. I think the Ohio State secondary, even after they lost Conley early, did an incredible job of shutting down the Oklahoma receivers, which right, Oklahoma just couldn't have people open down the field. And that's how Baker Mayfield has made that's what's made him so great, right? He's a Johnny Manziel type player who will just scramble forever until someone gets open or he finds or a running lane opens up or something. Right? He doesn't know, people commented that he doesn't really know how to throw the ball away, which is true because he almost never has to. Right? He can avoid a sack for almost forever until something opens up down the field. And that's what he's used to, and those are the big plays he made last year, and that's how he's made a name for himself. And Ohio State just didn't let him do that. The Ohio State secondary was just incredible. The not-discussed heroes of that game, the Ohio State secondary never really let Oklahoma get anything going down the field. And I don't know if Oklahoma plays another team who has the athletes that can do that. So I don't. A TCU secondary got lit up by South Dakota State. I'm not worried about Oklahoma against TCU. I think Oklahoma can score 50 points easily against them, unless TCU has made some major adjustments in the first month of the year. Texas will be an interesting game, but again, I don't think Texas has the speed in the secondary that Ohio State has to slow down the Oklahoma offense the same way. So I'm not worried about Oklahoma starting 1-4. I mean, TCU and Texas are both decent teams, so 2-3 is possible, but I'd be shocked if they lose both of those. And again, I think Baker Mayfield is going to have a good season because Ohio State managed to have the right defensive players to shut him down and stop what he's best at. Very few other teams Oklahoma's going to face will be able to do that. So I think I think it's still going to be a pretty good year for Oklahoma. Probably it'd be very unlikely to see them make the playoff at this point, which is what they were hoping for to start the year. But Big 12 title is definitely within reach. New Year's Six Day Bowl definitely still in reach. Baker Mayfield still is a talented quarterback. Right, one of the interceptions was a deflected ball to the line, not really his fault. One of them was a poor decision after scrambling, trying to force the ball that probably shouldn't have been thrown. But I'm not as worried as you are about Oklahoma.
Yeah, if they can manage those two games, they have a very good chance at maybe running the table, going 10-2, giving themselves a shot at the playoff. I don't want to get into that right now, but they would have a shot, and they obviously have a few more tough games down the line, but it's just a tough start for the Sooners, and they just couldn't get one of those two early wins against what looks like two top five or six teams, so you can't really fault the Sooners. Let's move on to the most impressive performance of the weekend, I would say. Louisville's drubbing of Florida State, 63-20. I just have to say, wow. I wasn't sure how good Lamar Jackson was. He really stood out. He locked up the September Heisman. which is good for him. Hopefully they can keep it up. But what I really want to harp on is just how well the Cardinals' defense played in this one. Five sacks, two turnovers. They limited Dalvin Cook to, I think it was 54 yards, and they brought tons of pressure, and they were just saying if DeAndre Francois can beat us, then so be it, but he wasn't able to, and that defense really opened my eyes as to how good they can really be. And the other thing, the contrast from Michigan State, I was really impressed that Louisville was able to keep their foot on the pedal and just keep not kind of give up and let Florida State have any chance at coming back. What were you impressed with by the Cardinals?
A few things. I mean, there's very little to not be impressed by, right? They dominated the whole game, never let up. Beat Florida State by 40 points, right? That's not something that happens often or ever. I think they scored the most points Florida State's ever given up. It's just a great game from Louisville. Some people before were calling it the biggest game in Louisville football history. If it wasn't viewed that way before the game, it's probably being viewed that way after the game. Lamar Jackson looks like I still have questions about how good of a passer he is, but when he can scramble like that, and when he's a decent enough passer that you can't just play him like he's only a running quarterback. So, and once he gets in the open field, right, he's very difficult to bring down, very shifty. He's almost like a running back that can throw the ball pretty well, as opposed to a good passer who can run very well. So maybe that's something that if teams study in a film and, like, can find a way to exploit it, maybe that's a small weakness. But he's just so good. He reminds me of Michael Vick in college. Right? That's something people say a lot with running quarterbacks, but it's not something that actually feels so true. It feels pretty true here.
Well, and we saw the quote from Vic where he said that Lamar Jackson is five times better than he
was.
Right,
yeah. That's high praise indeed. And the defense shut down Florida State. They shut it down better than Ole Miss did. The Ole Miss defense looks pretty – I mean, they haven't played so much this year, and the game against Alabama certainly didn't look great, but Ole Miss is definitely a talented defense. And Louisville did what they couldn't. So Louisville looks legit. Louisville looks like they're a strong team, and we'll see when they face Clemson. We'll see when they face Houston. Louisville against Houston in November. That could definitely be almost a playoff quarterfinal when we get there.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what happens when Louisville goes down to Clemson in 2 weeks, because it should be a very fun one. I don't have too many thoughts on Florida State. I'm disappointed. They were my national championship pick, but they didn't look up to snuff. Francois was as great as he looked in that second half of Ole Miss. He looked kind of equally bad in this one. They just couldn't really get.
If you want to see a very early overreaction, when the sportsbooks open lines for this week, Florida State is a 4-point favorite against South Florida. Right? South Florida out of the American Athletic Conference. That's not something anyone... I mean, South Florida is deceptive. It's actually very underrated this year. I think they could pose a real threat to Houston if they meet in the AAC Championship game. They have a dual-threat quarterback who no one's ever heard of and people should. I forget his first name. His last name is Flowers. I don't know him as well as I should, but he looks very good and talented. So people don't know that. So the line being 4 is just based on a judgment of Florida State, really, and not South Florida. And that line's not something anyone would ever expect to see.
Oh yeah, I hadn't seen that line yet. Quentin Flowers is his name. He's certainly
Quentin Flowers. Thank you.
Yeah, and it should be a closer game than people think, but I do think 4 is a little small because it is in South Florida, but yeah, wow, I hadn't seen that, but yeah, we'll just have to see how Florida State regroups. They obviously have Clemson down the line, and they still have a very real chance of at least making a New Year's Six Bowl, as they should. I think they just had a down week, and maybe weren't as ready for this one as Louisville was, maybe they're just not as good as we thought they were. Only time will tell, but we will see. Anything else on this one before we move on?
No, I think that about covers the game for me.
Let's move on to the I don't know if this was the biggest upset of the – I think it probably was. It was the biggest upset of the week. FCS Power, North Dakota State, coming off, I think it's 5 straight FCS championships, takes down the Iowa Hawkeyes 23-21 with a last-second field goal. North Dakota State actually implemented a similar formula to Michigan State. They dominated the line of scrimmage and just ran it down their throat. They were also disciplined like you'd expect a Michigan State team to be, with no first half penalties and just one turnover while controlling the ball for 37 minutes of play. And they were just able to shut down the bread and butter for Iowa, the run game. And I was very impressed by that. What else did you see out of North Dakota State that you liked?
Well, I don't watch it so much. I kind of keep a bit of an eye on FCS football because as college football, they have entertaining games too. And North Dakota State is not your average FCS team. They're not even your above average FCS team, right? And the voters know this, right? People around college football realize how good they are. Iowa lost to an FCS team and is still ranked in the coaches poll, right? Which says a lot more about North Dakota State than it says about Iowa. It says that the coaches think that losing to North Dakota State does not disqualify you from being ranked. North Dakota State, the most respect any the coaches poll since the I don't know before this, but when they started using it in the BCS, so the coaches poll didn't let you stop letting coaches. I don't know if they did before, but definitely then they said you can't vote for teams that aren't eligible for the BCS, which meant no FCS teams. The AP poll does let you vote for FCS teams. And North Dakota State received 74 votes, which was good for a tie for 27th place, where they almost actually made it into the top 25. It's the most votes an FCS team's ever received. If they win a few more and a few teams in front of them lose, we could actually see them be the first ever ranked FCS team, right, in the AP poll in college football history. This is not your average FCS team. This is a good FCS team that can play. Right, they have some matchup problems against the faster teams, but still they managed to win a shootout in overtime against Eastern Washington last week. They're versatile, they're strong in the line of scrimmage, which makes them a terrible matchup for teams like Iowa. So this says a lot more about North Dakota State than it does about Iowa. Iowa's still a pretty quality team. They'll still be able to challenge for the Big Ten West. Maybe they're a step behind Nebraska and Wisconsin right now. Maybe. So they won't quite be as successful as last year, but they're a good team. C.J. Beathard's a good quarterback, and just this is all about North Dakota State, showing that they can compete with really just about anyone. Iowa was a top, what were they last week, number 11 or 13 in some of the polls?
Yeah.
So this is all about North Dakota. This isn't Appalachian State, Michigan, where Michigan started the over. I mean, maybe we'll come to the end of the season and think Iowa was very overrated, but this doesn't seem like that. This just seems like North Dakota State, you know, is a powerful team that matched up well against Iowa and played basically a perfect game to be able to pull off a great upset. They wouldn't do this 6 times out of 10, but definitely 3 or 4.
Yeah.
So the Hawkeyes have to be disappointed, but this doesn't end their season, and I wouldn't call it the biggest upset of the week. Anyone who knows North Dakota State would think that this was definitely possible.
Well, yeah, I certainly think it was possible. Just many people did not see it coming. As you said, for Iowa, I don't think this is a giant loss. They still have many more big games on the schedule, and they still have a very good chance of not being the favorites, them and Wisconsin, to go out and win the Big Ten West. But we'll see as the season goes on. They have a few easy ones if they play Wisconsin, so it'll be interesting to see how they rebound. But it's very cool to see North Dakota State and come in and do this and then get the national recognition they kind of deserve from FCS skeptics, I guess you could say. Any final thoughts on this one?
Not really. I've written a column, an eliminator column for the College Football Playoff. Since the playoff started. Right, counting down, one of my rules is always I eliminate any team who loses to an FCS team. The logic is clear. If you can't beat a team in a lower division, how can you ever claim you're the best in college football? And I just had to make an exception for that this week because North Dakota State is not a normal FCS team. And if Iowa can win out and beat, you know, Michigan, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and then take out either Ohio State or Michigan State or maybe Michigan again in the Big Ten Championship game, very likely Iowa, even with this loss, is in the playoffs. And that's just as much a testament to how much respect North Dakota State gets and how good North Dakota State is than it is to this being a bad loss for Iowa.
I would be fascinated to see if they come off that Michigan win 9-1, where they're ranked and what people are talking about, because there would be some hot takes both ways in terms of that for sure. But let's move on to another Big Ten West team, the Nebraska Cornhuskers, taking down the Oregon Ducks in Lincoln 35-32. I was able to be in attendance in this one. First of all, if you get a chance to go to Memorial Stadium, I would highly recommend it. It's an awesome venue for a game. The fans are awesome and everything. But for the Ducks, they were just drowned out by penalties and their whole two-point conversion spiel that didn't end up working out this week. They went 1-for-5. They got the first one and proceeded not to get any of the rest. And if they just kick extra points, it ends up being a tied game. Obviously, the game could play out differently, but I'm not too angry about that. It's kind of what you get as a for when you're watching the Ducks. It's what you kind of expect. But the penalties were really the killer. 12 penalties for 124 yards, and many of them came at the worst possible time. What did you think about the Oregon mistakes in this one?
I mean, right, I hate playing the, you know, what-if games, because every change in any play, you know, changes everything. So, right, you talk about, oh, Oregon doesn't make this penalty, so what happens, right? How does Nebraska react? How does Oregon react?
Yeah.
So it's really a difficult game to play, but it's definitely true that Oregon, if they played a cleaner game, the outcome could have been very different. Nebraska responded well to everything Oregon did. I think this might have been one of Tommy Armstrong's. He's clearly very talented, but this would have been one of his cleanest games. So I think Nebraska just looks good on offense. It's interesting. People are giving Nebraska more credit after this win than Oregon was getting before the game was even played, which is interesting. Because, right, if the logic is beating Oregon means you're better than Oregon, so should be about where Oregon was before, not much higher than that. But I guess people want to see Nebraska be really good again. Or maybe this game made people realize Oregon might be better than they thought. I think Oregon, people wrote them off before the season way too early. People have been writing them off as challengers in the Pac-12. And if they don't play more disciplined, they're going to have a lot of trouble. But Oregon looks like a talented team. I haven't seen an injury update on Royce Freeman, but hopefully he's okay. I don't know if you've seen anything since the game.
After the game, their offensive coordinator, Matt Lubick, was asked about him, and Devin Allen, the USA hurler, was also injured, and he started to get emotional, but I still haven't seen a...
I saw a tweet saying that, but I didn't see anything official saying, you know, with any sort of estimate or prognosis. Okay, so if they lose either of them, but Freeman probably a little more than Allen... those would be huge losses, but Oregon's just fast. Maybe they're not quite as good as they were 5 years ago, but they're still a talented team and should be able to challenge in the Pac-12. And Nebraska, hopefully I'm going to be able to attend that Nebraska-Ohio State game on November 5th, but Nebraska should easily be 7-0 when they travel to Madison to face Wisconsin at the end of October, and Wisconsin has a brutal schedule between now and then, so that game might not have as much hype as we're thinking now. Wisconsin, I think the next three games, or three of the next four, right, the next three games are Michigan State, Michigan, and Ohio State. So Wisconsin should probably be at absolute best, a two-loss team by the time they face Nebraska, but that should be a great game. And then Nebraska's 8-0 coming into Ohio State, you're going to have the entire country looking at Columbus for that one. Because Nebraska looks strong. They look very good.
Yeah, I think the defense for the Ducks it looked a little bit improved from a season ago. I was worried coming into it. I guess they outperformed my expectations, but that's not saying much. I think the real difference for the Cornhuskers was just Armstrong's ability to get outside the pocket and make plays. He did that on multiple big third down plays, and I was very impressed by that. Just a few more things on Oregon. Like you said, that Royce Freeman injury could be devastating. They obviously have plenty of quality backs, but not a all-conference sort of back there. Benoit and Brooks James looked fine, but it would be crushing if that happened. And Prukop, the FCS transfer quarterback, he was okay. He really had some trouble reading the read option. He kind of seemed selfish in a way. It just didn't work out. And then the last play of the game when they were kind of going for a Hail Mary, he decided to take it and run on about a 4th and 16, which you see Charles Nelson throw his hands up in the air. So it'll be interesting to see if the locker room kind of gets that sorted out, just to see if there's any frustration with the quarterback position.
Prukop is Prukop. He's still got a lot to learn. It's a bit of a problem. Right, last year we saw it was a tremendous difference between Oregon, even on defense, which is interesting. Between when they had a quarterback when Adams was healthy, as opposed to when they were stuck with Jeff Lockett as a backup.
Yeah.
I don't remember if we're running last year, 2 years ago, or whether they were stuck with Lockett or Adams with a broken finger. It really made a difference to the entire team. Even the defensive efficiency was just much less when they didn't have an efficient quarterback, which is fascinating, but not really relevant here. So Oregon needs a quarterback to run the offense well. I think Prukop has talent, so I think he'll be able to learn. If he's not making right decisions, then the offense can't really go anywhere, no matter how much speed they have all around.
He didn't make any mistakes, which is a good thing. And if you watch him throw, it's actually kind of amazing. He doesn't step into a single throw, and it's pretty strange, actually. It's all arm. I don't know if that's a positive or a negative, but it's just interesting to watch.
Well, so was Tommy Armstrong when he started. That's what everyone said about him, too, right?
Yeah, very true. Let's move. Those are the six big ones of the weekend that we kind of covered. Let's move on to some quick hitters. Houston and Michigan both survive upset attempts. Houston takes down Cincinnati 40-16. Michigan survives Colorado's upset attempt. For Houston, this game was much closer than score indicated. There were two pick sixes in the final 6 minutes or so that kind of sealed the deal for Houston, but Cincinnati made this a game going in the fourth quarter.
I think Cincinnati led in the fourth quarter, right?
Oh, yes, they did. You're right, because then Houston scored at the beginning of it. They gave themselves a shot. What do you think of Houston and Cincinnati's performances?
Well, I was impressed by Cincinnati. I mean, they couldn't finish, and Houston really buckled down. I don't know how Tom Herman's done it, but the last 2 years, Houston, the difference between Houston being just pretty good and being really good is that they're the most efficient team when it comes to turnovers in the country. I don't know how you coach that, but apparently Tom Herman can do it. And so in this game, Cincinnati played well. The defense managed to slow down Houston. Greg Ward might still not be fully healthy, but the defense did an excellent job. But when Houston got those turnovers, it was all over. So I think Cincinnati's a talented team. Beating them by not too much isn't something embarrassing. But it's not something that Houston really can afford, right? If we apply the old Boise State principle from, the end of the BCS era when everyone was wondering, right? Now, the season never worked out for them, but when everyone was wondering whether Boise State, would have a chance or should deserve a chance, right? Everyone always knew that unless Boise was blowing out teams, so because the schedule is that much weaker, so they're for sure not as good as teams that might not look as dominant in power conferences, and Houston, the same principle the same principle is going to be applied to Houston. If you're losing in the fourth quarter in multiple AAC games, right, no one's going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, it may not matter now with Louisville being much better than everyone expected, but Houston still has to impress in these games. And I think the 24-point, even if it was, because of 14 points off pick six is late, I think the 24-point margin of victory gives Houston a little more, breathing room than this game could have otherwise indicated. But if Houston wants to be viewed as a serious contender late in the season, they can't afford too many close games against teams in conference. Whether that's fair or not, right, the American Athletic Conference has some good teams. Navy, well, they lost a lot, but Navy was good last year. Memphis still looks talented. They're going to face probably South Florida or Cincinnati in the championship game. So whether it's fair or not, because the AAC has some good teams, Houston's going to be judged by how they look just as much as wins and losses. So unless they can put in a dominant performance against Louisville, right, too many close wins against AAC teams is really gonna hurt their case.
Yeah, I think in the end, though, this will end up looking like just a fine win, like you said, just because they're not going to go back and go through game script of every single game and whether it was close in the fourth quarter or not.
Even if the committee claims they do, they're really not going to do that.
Yeah, they really shouldn't, because there's a reason the games are 60 minutes. But Houston's run defense, I am extremely impressed by. They shut down the Oklahoma duo in week one, and then this week they allowed 30 yards on 1.2 yards per carry for Cincinnati. So that's something just to watch as they go against some tougher rushing attacks going forward, heading up to the Louisville game. But yeah, I think I don't have too much more to say about that one. Let's move on to the other potential upset, I guess you could say, Michigan surviving Colorado. Colorado started off on a quick 14-0 start after a touchdown and then a strip sack defensive touchdown. And it was impressive for Michigan just to come back in that one. This was being called maybe the biggest CU game in 10 years. The buzz of the program is getting up there, but ultimately injuries and special teams ended up haunting them. Special teams, two block punts, one for a field goal, and they allowed a punt return touchdown. They scored it up by kicker and star defensive end to what looked like bad injuries. At least two of those three already out for the year. But ultimately, Michigan was just the better team, and they showed their power on the ground and through the air.
Right. Michigan basically spotted Colorado 14 points and made it a 55-minute game.
Yeah.
Basically. Not that it mattered so much. Colorado, I think, took the lead again in the third quarter very briefly on a great long pass. But Michigan really looked like the better team throughout much of this game. So it shows that Michigan had a good team make mistakes, though. First of all, it shows that Colorado has drastically improved over the past few years. Right, Colorado, they might still be at the bottom of the Pac-12, but they're no longer the easy – that this game shows they're no longer going to be the easy win that they've been basically since they moved into that conference. They could probably win. Just looking at Pac-12 play, right, in the Pac-12 South, they probably definitely could be Arizona, could challenge Arizona State probably. So this game says good things about Colorado, even if the final scores, they lost by three scores. And it shows Michigan that Michigan is clearly better, much more talented. But, you know, if you slip up, if you don't play your best even for a little bit. So, right, two plays, right, the 70-yard touchdown pass and the strip sack, right, two little plays is 14 points. And 14 points when you're against a decent team can really make a huge difference. So it's a bit of a warning for Michigan that they can't let plays like that happen, because if they're against a team that's better than Colorado, if they do that against Wisconsin, for example, they're going to be in a world of trouble. And not to mention Michigan State or Ohio State, but even against Wisconsin, right, letting up long scoring plays will be very difficult to come back from. And for Colorado, this game shows good signs. There was a bit of a fun going on Twitter between them. Colorado was confident coming in, and I guess they showed they had a decent reason to be confident. Maybe a little overconfident, because maybe they were underestimating just how good Michigan is, but Colorado looks much better than they've looked in a long time.
And the big key is whether Sefa Lufau, their starting senior quarterback, what the extent of his ankle injury is. I haven't heard too much about it, but they go to Oregon next week.
Right. Well, I think I saw on Twitter recently that X-rays were negative, so nothing's broken.
That's good. So probably just a sprain, which isn't good. But he's people all over the Buffalo's Twitter kind of – they say he's one of the toughest guys in all of college football. So if there's a chance he plays, he'll make it through. But this is a team with bowl aspirations, and if they don't have him, those might just go to waste. But it should be interesting, as they will be more competitive in the Pac-12 this year. With a down Arizona team, a down USC team, and Arizona State isn't as good as they have been. So it'll be interesting to watch for sure. Let's move on to one of the more exciting games of the weekend. Pittsburgh took on Oklahoma State in Stillwater. This game was tied at 38 with 12 minutes left, so it took a two-hour weather delay. Kind of ruined all the fun that was about to proceed, but Mike Gundy actually said that it ended up helping his team. They had a few things that they wanted to point out, and that coaching time certainly helped them as they were able to win this game 45-38. The Mason Rudolph-James Washington combination was very, very good, combining for 9 completions for 296 yards and 2 touchdowns. It's pretty unbelievable. Washington is one of the better receivers across the country. And I'm really starting to question the Pittsburgh defense, whether they're actually good or not, because I thought the strength of the team was the defensive backs, and it hasn't looked to be the case after giving up plenty of points this week and last week to Penn State. So we will see how they turn out. What do you like out of this game?
Right. Well, we mentioned that last week, that I thought it was more Penn State's offense being impressive, and you thought it was more Pitt's defense not being up to snuff. And this game certainly looked like you were right. Pitt's passing defense, right? Pat Narduzzi was the manufacturer of Michigan State's no-fly zone a few years ago, and that's nowhere to be seen. Pitt has serious problems in the passing defense department, and against North Carolina next week, that's going to be big trouble. I'm nervous about Pitt. Oklahoma State looked good, not great. Definitely played better this week than last week, unless you really think Pitt and Central Michigan are about equal. I don't, but another early line this week that I found fascinating, Central Michigan is actually favored over Virginia. Just an aside, they're outright favorites. Not often you see a MAC team be an outright favorite over an ACC team, even if Virginia is not so good.
Do you know where that game's at?
I do not offhand.
I can look it up real quick.
I can look it up real quick also. The game is at Virginia.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is pretty interesting. Virginia isn't great, but yeah, that's
right.
That's
fascinating. Central Michigan's getting respect, but that's a little off topic. But yeah, so I was disappointed in the Pitt defense, that trouble through the air. Oklahoma State, the defense definitely looked better in those last 12 minutes than did the rest of the game. So I think obviously Mike Gundy's right about his team, but I think what happened is borne out by what he said, that having those 2 hours, you know, work on how to properly stop Pitt's defense definitely helped. How to stop Pitt's offense, I'm sorry, definitely helped. And Oklahoma State, yes, if they survive this game, and if they lost this game, it would be big trouble for their whole season. So this game was more about surviving than winning, especially if Pitt's not as good as we expected. But Oklahoma State is going to be coming into a 12th play instead of, you know, despondent and frustrated after the Central Michigan game. So they have a very good note to enter Big 12 play on. And they should be one of the favorites in the Big 12. I don't think they're as talented as Oklahoma. I don't know how well they'll be able to stop Baylor or TCU, but TCU won't be able to stop them either. That game, I don't care what the line is, but the over. But Oklahoma State looks solid going into Big 12 play.
Yeah, and they take on Baylor next weekend, which should be a fun one. We'll see what Baylor is really made of after a typical Baylor non-conference schedule. So we will see how that goes. I think that's all we got for that one. Let's move on to the SEC, where there were 3 interesting games going on Saturday night. We got Texas A&M beating Auburn 29-16. We got LSU squeaking out the victory over Michigan State 23-20. And Georgia coming back late to beat Missouri 28-27. What stood out to you in those 3 games?
Sure, let's start with Georgia, right? Let's not pretend that Missouri is any good. They have no offense whatsoever, and they put up 27 on Georgia. the week after Georgia also survived against Nichols. Georgia here needed a 4th-and-10 conversion with a minute and a half left or so to get past Missouri. This is not a good look for the Bulldogs. You can only say survive in advance so many times before you have to reach, especially against bad teams, where you have to raise serious questions. And if how they played the last 2 weeks is any indication, their game next week against Ole Miss will not be pretty. If they give 27 to Mizzou's offense, I'd be very concerned as to what Chad Kelly and Ole Miss is going to do to them. But they only gave up 24 to North Carolina, so I don't know how to judge this team. But based on the last 2 weeks, they're in trouble.
I think this is one of those teams that we're going to see all year where they're just kind of playing to their level of their competition, because that's really what it seems like. Just to give Missouri a little bit of credit, I think their quarterback, Drew Locke, is better than they've been in the past, but Georgia certainly should have pounded them. Nick Chubb obviously wasn't able to get going as much as they expected. Continue. Sorry for interrupting.
I don't know. That's fine. I watched Missouri play West Virginia. West Virginia does not have a great defense.
That's very true.
Right. Missouri scored 11 points. Drew Locke was 23-51, which is not great. And the numbers are a bit inflated because they use the bubble screen a bunch, I think. Well, if I'm messing up my teams. He's a FBS level quarterback, but he's not one of the great ones. I'm not such a fan of Drew Locke. Missouri has no running game to counter for that. Almost nothing. At least at Aiden against West Virginia. So I don't know. I find a hard time buying that Missouri has an offense that, you know, scoring points that giving up 27 points to doesn't just look bad.
Yeah, I guess I was just trying to play devil's advocate a little bit, but.
I mean, maybe the season will show that you're right. I mean, it's still early. Teams get better, teams get worse. Teams do just play bad games and, you know, move on from it. I don't know if 3 games is enough to judge as to whether Georgia's going to fall into that this year.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. You could definitely be right. It wouldn't surprise me if you're right, because they did look really good against North Carolina in the first week. So a bit of an enigma right now, but I'd still be very worried. That's not something you can, you know, turn on and off playing, you know, well against a good team and bad and not so well against a bad team. Next 2 games are Mississippi and Tennessee, so I'd be worried about Georgia. And, you know, maybe this was Missouri showing that they're a little better than they showed in week 1, and they'll have a successful season. Could be. Doesn't look that way to me right now, but you never know. But yeah, that's what I think about Georgia in this game.
And then the A&M game, I came out impressed by their defense for sure. Auburn, some people kind of thought they might have a quarterback, but that obviously proved quite wrong after only scoring 16 points. And the A&M defensive front really getting after them. Sean White, only 126 yards, and they were using that great three quarterback system. No, just two tonight. But
we'll see how many they use over the season.
And then the A&M rushing attack was good. Trevor Knight was able to get the ball to their playmakers, and they did enough to win this one in Auburn. I was fairly impressed. What did you see out of this one?
Yeah, the A&M defense should be the story of this game. I actually wasn't so impressed with the A&M offense. I thought they had lots of chances. Maybe I'm underestimating Auburn a little, but I thought the A&M offense just couldn't really get any great rhythm and do. I mean, they did enough, but couldn't really do what I was expecting of them. But the defense should be the story of this game. The defense looks strong. How they won in the trenches against Auburn. Auburn never really found any. I don't know if Auburn has a quarterback good enough to find a good offensive rhythm, but they never really gave Auburn that chance. So I think the A&M defense is a takeaway from this. And I mean, right, the test in the SEC West is Alabama. A&M has Tennessee first, and then they get a bye in Alabama in a month on October 22nd. So, well, first, the latest this week against Arkansas is is something everyone's looking forward to in the SEC, but I think Arkansas is a bit overrated because I think everyone's high on Arkansas after that TCU game. But I think TCU hasn't looked good at all yet this year. I can't get over the fact that Arkansas, everyone thinks Arkansas is such a great team when they probably should have lost to Louisiana Tech. So I'm not as hyped about the game against Texas A&M this week as everyone else is. I think Texas A&M, I think I want to wait to see how Texas A&M can do against Alabama. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. But Texas A&M looks good. The defense looks strong. And I don't expect them to have any problems against Arkansas this week.
Yeah, I think that defensive line will kind of have their way with the Arkansas running game and see if Arkansas can actually move the ball in the air with Austin Allen. But that should be a fun one. I kind of thought people had been underrating A&M this year, coming into the year, and they've kind of, I don't want to say proved me right, but they've looked good so far. That defensive line is pretty unbelievable, and their offense has just done enough to win that. So they do have some upcoming tests, as you said, but we'll see how that goes. And the defense did produce 4 sacks and 13 tackles for loss, which was very impressive, but I think it also says a lot about the Auburn offense, which is quite putrid, and Gus Malzahn is not looking like much of an offensive wizard. And the final SEC game that we have yet to talk about, we got LSU squeaking out the victory over Mississippi State after they allowed them to come back from their 23-3 lead. I don't know what to say about this LSU team. They're very confusing, and I don't really know what to think about them quite yet. But what do you think about this one?
Well, LSU should have had this game in hand. I think the defense kind of collapsed in the last few possessions, which is never a good look for a team. It's funny because we're used to LSU doing the opposite. You have a strong defense, and their offense wears down opponents to the point where, you know, the opponent's defense just can't do anything late in the game. Think back to the Wisconsin game 2013. I think that was 2014. That was the epitome of that. I was very surprised to see LSU's defense just stop working the way it did. The offense solves problems. Leonard Fournette, still a beast, but doesn't quite look as great this year as he did last year. Maybe some lingering pain from the Wisconsin game. I don't know, it took a hard hit on the shin towards the end of that game. So I don't know what it is there. Danny Etling didn't quite look as good this week as he did last week, which is sort of to be expected. But the offense really opened up last week against Jacksonville State when he came in, and this week it wasn't the same. It was good enough. It moved the ball much better than it would have with Harris back at quarterback. Probably. Can't say for sure, but probably. And so I don't know what to think about this team. Tons of talent all across the board. Right, really dynamic wide receivers and a quarterback who can kind of throw to them now. Some great running backs and just can't seem to just put it together and make plays. So I really don't know what to think of them either.
Yeah, if you look at the LSU game log, for their drives, they had 3 3-and-out punts in the second half, along with 2 fumbles and then the end of game kneeling. So they really weren't able to get much of anything going. The one drive that had any amount of success, it did take 7 minutes off the clock, but it ended in a fumble. So you really need to start to see some consistency from LSU's offense. I guess we've been saying that for a very long time now, so we'll see if that comes about. Any final thoughts on this one?
No, not really. LSU's an enigma. Mississippi State is not so great. The loss to South Alabama is still, right, if you look at the score, right, LSU is about the same as South Alabama, which just doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, comparing opponents and all, but just relative to Mississippi State. I don't know what to think about this team.
They do go to Auburn next week, so that quarterback battle could be quite ugly. But I do expect LSU to kind of pound Auburn. At least they should.
And that will be my guess also, but we'll see.
Yeah. Before they play Missouri and at Florida, their tougher games come at the end of the season, but So they, I guess they're lucky. They have some time to figure it out, and their defense gives them some breathing room. The final games of the evening were mostly the Pac-12 games, as you would expect, Pac-12 after dark. We saw Stanford put away USC pretty handily. Washington continued their dominant run. UCLA squeaked it out against BYU. Utah beat San Jose State, and Arizona was able to beat Hawaii. But the game that I want to kind of key in on over all of them is that Cal victory over number 11 Texas, 50-43. And this was the other game with the dropped fumble by running back Vic Enwere near the end of the game. And I know you have some strong thoughts and kind of want to dive deep into this one.
Well, I just want to read a rule. I searched through the rule book for this Saturday night and last night because, right, everyone. People know that when this happens, the ball lands in the end zone, no one picks it up, so you bring it back out to the one-yard line. I can't figure out why. I'm going to read this rule. This is approved ruling 8-2-1-X. Right, it's approved ruling in the back of the NCAA rule book. And the keys is not 100% identical, but it reads like this. Ball carrier A33, so on team A, is running towards the team B goal line. He drops the ball just inside the one-yard line and, thinking he has scored a touchdown, circles through the end zone and runs to his team area. That's basically what we have, right? He goes, drops the ball one-yard line and goes to celebrate. There is no touchdown signal by any official. So that's what that in this rule is what makes it different than our play. But so there's no touchdown signal. The fumbled ball hits the ground just outside or just inside the goal line, rolls along the ground in the end zone, and is declared dead there when it comes to rest and no player attempts to recover it. Right, a fumble is just like a punt, right? If the ball comes to rest and no one tries to recover for a bit, so the refs just blow it dead. Just like a punt, if you don't down it, so the refs will blow it dead after a few seconds. So if no one tries to recover it, they'll blow the ball dead. And the ruling in this case, the rule says the ruling is touchdown. The ball belongs to the team last in possession of the dead ball spot, right? By definition, an awarded fumble in the opponent's end zone is a touchdown. So the dead ball spot is in the end zone. The team that last had the ball keeps the ball. So this ruling says this play is a touchdown. Now, our play is a little different because our play, there is a touchdown signal given, which is why we play, right? The ball is declared dead. But I don't see why it's any different. It's declared dead in the end zone, right? If I rule it still belongs to Cal, if the ball is declared dead in the end zone and it belongs to Cal, it should be a touchdown. So I don't understand at all why this rule isn't being applied. I sent tweets out to Mike Pereira and Dave Kataya. I consider myself a bit of a rules nerd, but I'll admit that I'm no expert like these guys are. So I'm waiting on someone to try and answer and explain this to me. But that's what I see. I see no rule anywhere in the rule book. I literally read through the entire relevant sections twice, all of Rule 12 about instant replay, all of Rule 8 about scoring, all of Rule about fumbles, to try and just figure out why exactly, right, they do this, why they bring the ball out to the one-yard line, because this is what's done in every game when this happens, right? If it goes out of the end zone, so it's a touchback, because the fumble that goes out of the end zone is a touchback. But if it's just the end zone and had been ruled a touchdown and replay review shows that it wasn't, I don't know why this rule isn't relevant, and I don't know why it's always being called a why the ball's being brought out to the 1 yard line and not being called a touchdown.
The one thing that really interests me is if you're watching this game, there is a Texas player who goes and picks it up, but it's like it's at a very awkward time where it's not like immediately after, but it's not like super late. So I think that's where
right.
Most of the controversy stems from.
Maybe, but I think that's just a mistake in controversy. I think clearly that is not immediate because two Cal players ran past the ball after the referee had signaled touchdown. So you can't, right, the whole point of it being immediate is because you can't pretend, well, what would have happened if he hadn't signaled touchdown, right? Would those Cal players have thought it was a touchdown anyway and run to celebrate anyway? You know, what they had done? Like, you just can't think like that. You can't have a rule like that, which is the whole purpose of the immediate recovery rule. It has to be immediate. And show that, like, no one else had a chance to do anything. And two Cal players clearly run past the ball. So, and if there had been no touchdown signal, right, who knows, but maybe they could have picked it up. And because of those questions, right, because you can't ask that, so it has to be that rule is not immediate. So I think the referee certainly got that part right, that it should have been, that definitely was not an immediate Texas recovery, even though a Longhorn player picked it up about 2.5-3 seconds later. But just in context, right, immediate is inherently subjective because it really depends on the play and what's happening and who's nearby and everything. So that's why you can't just play make believe and say, well, what if the ref hadn't done anything?
Yeah.
So that's why I think the referees for sure got that right, that it wasn't immediate because two Cal players did run by. And you know, if there had been no signal, no whistle, they easily could have jumped on the ball. Two other Texas players also ran by who easily could have tried to jump on the ball, and that's why it wasn't immediate. So I'm not worried about that part. I'm very curious though why the rule I read isn't relevant.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And just this whole dropping the ball before the end zone thing, I think it'll really come to the national spotlight this week more than I think it ever has, maybe outside the DeSean Jackson play a few years ago. And I think it'll be a real touching point for coaches and players and referees alike. But yeah, I don't really have an answer for you, and that's a very good question. And you probably have to get someone smarter than either of us to answer that.
So hopefully, Mike Pereira or Nick Tatias see my tweet and give an explanation for everyone, because I'm very curious what's going on here with this. Another point about that. This has been a pet peeve of mine ever since I saw a Cincinnati-UConn game maybe 7 years ago and realized it. where the game was, I forget who scored, this was 7 years ago, but it was Cincinnati against UConn, I remember that clearly. A minute and a half left, the team was up by two. Rand got the first down, that should have sealed the game, went ahead and scored the touchdown, and then the other team came back and scored a touchdown and had a chance at an onside kick. And so forget, you know, just running through the end zone and scoring. For Cal, the right play, the play that wins the game automatically, is getting the first down and sliding and taking East end of the game. And there's no reason to ever give Texas a chance to get the ball back. So this has been a pet peeve of mine for a long time. When a game, especially with a one-point lead, I've seen it happen, where a game is iced, right? The game is over if you just slide and then take knees. And then someone will go ahead and score. And usually it doesn't matter because, again, the odds of, I mean, in this game, actually, with the no defense, it actually is a little problem. It is a bit of a problem. But, right, Cal probably have this game won even if they score the touchdown. But if they don't score the touchdown and slide down after getting the first down, right, it's a guaranteed win.
I think
the ball back, give them a chance to score and get an outside kick. Right, things can happen.
I think it's a weird thing to say, but I think it's a bit of a selfish play, I'd say, because the players want their own glory and the touchdown and everything.
Right, but you see defensive players able to do this all the time, right? You get the
interception,
you run a bit, and then you realize, and so some of them, they start running, so that's your first reaction. But then very quickly, they'll slide, they don't want to get hit and possibly fumble, or, you know, anything weird can happen. The defensive players know all the time. You get the ball, you end the play as soon as you can, so nothing weird happens, and you slide. And I don't get why offensive players can't seem to do this. You see, it's so rare. I think in actually a more interesting situation, Maurice Jones-Drew did it on the Jaguars a few years back. I think it was like a tie game with a minute and a half left. So he slid down early so they could take knees and kick a game-winning field goal instead of scoring the touchdown. We see it in big games. Teams get this right in big games. We saw it in the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
in the Super Bowl with the Giants, the Patriots, where it was funny, where both offense and defense got it right. Defense tried to let them score because that was the only chance of getting the ball back and winning. Offense barely successfully managed to fall down before scoring.
Yeah,
we saw this in the Auburn-Oregon National Championship game where, you know, Cam Newton stood himself up at the one-yard line so they kicked the game-winning field goal as time expired instead of scoring and giving Oregon a chance to get the ball back with, you know, a very small chance, right, a minute to score, but a small chance is better than almost no chance.
Yeah.
So we see guys get it right in the biggest situations, but this should be an every game thing. Coaches should tell their team, right, before they come out for the third down play, right, get the first down and five.
That's a very good point. And just overall, this was the first half was incredibly fun. If you like points in this Texas-Cal game, circling back because we kind of got off topic, but that is a very good point by you. At halftime, it was 35-33. Cal was leading, and it was a fun game if you were able to stay up for it. The second half was a little bit dead, but it was certainly a good game and a huge win for Cal. Kind of surprising, honestly, to me. Were there any other things you wanted to touch on in these late Pac-12 games that really stood out to you?
Nothing stood out so much. A Friday night Pac-12 game, actually, that's not getting enough attention. Arizona State, too, coming off a huge win. They had 8 touchdowns by Ballage against Texas Tech. They really struggled, probably should have lost to Texas San Antonio. Needed big 17 points in the fourth quarter. So a little surprised, a little disappointed in Arizona State. You know, I was impressed by UCLA. UCLA played well against BYU. BYU is a talented team. Kalani's attacking, getting used to things, maybe made a few poor decisions. But he looks like they like him over in Provo, so it looks like he's getting the hang of his program there. Just a bit of growing pains, but UCLA did well to win that. And I didn't have such a good way to watch it, but I peeked in on Utah against San Jose State. Utah did enough to win, but really didn't impress me in this game. San Jose State's not that good a team, and Utah let them stay in the game, you know. And it was pretty close for far too long. But UCLA, I think we should point out, UCLA played well. Defense was excellent against Taysom Hill. Offense needs work, but BYU has a very good defense, so we shouldn't be too worried about that. But yeah, UCLA is worth noting that they played very well, and Utah, this game was never going to be out of hand, so not a huge deal. But you a little concerned for Utah after seeing them not play so great against San Jose State.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. They take on USC on Friday night, so that'll be fun to watch because USC has obviously been underwhelming, and we'll see how good Utah really is. Because I think I'm a little higher on them than you are, but we'll see how that all plays out. And then, as we said, the Arizona took down Hawaii by just 19.
Arizona looks awful.
Yeah,
Hawaii's awful. Arizona does not look good at all. Almost lost to Grambling. They actually look okay in their opening game against BYU. They look pretty good. Offense seems to work. Defense looks solid against Taysom Hill and BYU. But Arizona did not look good against Hawaii, even though if you look at the score, it looked out of hand. But it really kind of wasn't. Hawaii's not a good team this year. Haven't had a chance to rest yet to really regroup at all. Hawaii's not a good team this year. And Arizona just doesn't look good so far.
Yeah, they could easily take that bottom spot from Colorado finally in the Pac-12 South. I think that's all we have for this weekend. Any final thoughts on a fun week 3 in college football?
Nothing so much more than what we said. Tennessee, we spoke about Tennessee last week and how great they looked for half against Virginia Tech, or 3/4 against Virginia Tech, how poor they looked against Appalachian State, and they looked poor against Ohio again. Fan who knows the program very well said that was kind of intentional. Not that they didn't want to look good, because they were getting beaten in the line of scrimmage against Ohio, which is just not a good look. Very similar against Appalachian State, but they rested some players because of injury concerns. The play calling was intentionally very conservative because they knew the Ohio game was in hand. So even though it's not a good look, maybe it's not one that Tennessee fans should be concerned about. But it definitely wasn't such a good look from Tennessee this week.
And this week, is there that big rivalry where they try and snap the Florida winning streak finally for the Volunteers? So we'll see how they look. Florida starting quarterback Jack Del Rio is out for the foreseeable future, so it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. But let's see if Tennessee steps it up.
Yeah. That's a big loss for Florida, but fun fact is that Florida's won the last, I think, 2 or 3 games, I think it's 2, against Tennessee by playing a backup quarterback, so who knows? Be interesting to see that if that continues. Before we close, I want to say Miami was impressive. Miami beat down Appalachian State. It was a very impressive victory. I Ken, you're not usually impressed by beating down Sunbelt teams, but Appalachian State's not your normal Sunbelt team, and Miami just looked good in that game.
Yeah, and they could easily take the Coastal. They played well this year, and we'll see how they can do that. But that was certainly a very impressive game, and Connor and I previewed that one, and we kind of thought that Miami would take it to Appalachian State, and they did just that. I think that's all we got for you. You have anything you want to plug right now?
No, I think that's all my thoughts on this week.
All right. Well, you can follow me on Twitter at @A_Craycraft. What's your Twitter handle?
Yes, YESH222.
And then go to Last Word on College Football, where we've reviewed week 3 and we're gearing up for week 4. We got plenty of previews. A big game in the Last Word on Sports community with Tennessee taking on Florida. There are some supporters of both teams that should be a fun one. And yeah, follow us on Twitter at Last Word on CFP. We'll talk to you guys later in week 4. Thanks, and see you all later.